Then, feeling totally surreal, I tiptoe upstairs, not even sure why I'm tiptoeing. I hesitate for a moment on the landing, trying to stay calm, then slowly venture into Dan's study. I know exactly where I'm heading, but I pretend to myself that I'm just having a general look round. I shuffle through some papers about a planning decision. I examine a brochure from a rival office construction company. I discover an old school report of Anna's in Dan's in-tray and find myself reading comments on her handwriting. Then, at last, my pulse beating quickly, I find the little key on his key ring. I stare at it for a moment, thinking, do I really want to do this? What if I find? The truth is, I don't know what I'll find. My mind won't even go there. But I'm here. I'm on a mission. I'm going to see it through. At last, swiftly, I bend down and unlock his secret desk drawer, my hand trembling so much that I have to try 3 times. But then I've got it open, and I'm staring at what's inside. I'm not sure what I was expecting to find, but it's the phone. The Samsung phone I saw last night. Just that. Nothing else. I take it out, thinking wildly, wait, what about fingerprints? And then, don't be ridiculous, this isn't CSI. I press in Dan's usual passcode and get straight in. Clearly he never expected me to find it, which kind of comforts me, and kind of doesn't. It's a pretty new phone. There are only 24 texts on it, back and forth. As I scroll down, I see they're all to the same person. Mary. And I just stare, unable to process the enormity of what I'm seeing. It's a nightmare. Worst-case scenario. My shoulders are rising and falling. My brain is shouting panicky messages at me like, what? And, does that mean? And, please, no, this is wrong. This has to be wrong. And, almost worst of all, was Tilda right all along? Did I bring this on myself? I can feel rising tears mixed with rising incredulity and rising dread. I'm not sure yet which is winning. Actually, yes, I am. Incredulity is winning, and it's joining forces with anger. Really? I feel like shouting. Really, Dan? Everything else I could rationalize. The moods, the familiar vibe between Dan and Mary, even the hug. But not this. Not these messages in black and white. Good to talk in 5. 10 a.m. Starbucks? It's okay, have distracted S. Today was a bit tricky. At home, can't talk. Remember, P.S. factor. Going insane today, she is nuts. 11 a.m. Villandry. Running late, sorry. Thank God for you. And so it goes on. I read all 24 messages twice. I take photos of everything with my phone because, just because, might come in useful. Then I put the Samsung back with my fingertips, feeling as though it's contaminated. I shut the desk drawer, lock it carefully, check it again, and back away, as though from the crime scene. On the landing, I look around, feeling dazed, as though seeing our house for the first time. Our home, our little nest, with its wedding presents, and prints we bought on holiday, and photos of the girls everywhere. All this time I've spent trying to make it cozy, trying to make it Hygge, trying to create a place for us as a couple to retreat from the world. Now I look at my stupid candles, and throws, and carefully placed cushions, and I want to shred them all. I want to destroy them and throw them onto the street and yell, okay, well, fuck you then, Dan! Fuck you! Dan doesn't want to escape with me. He wants to escape from me. Maybe it was our session in the secret garden that triggered a sudden latent passion for Mary. Maybe this is all really new and exciting for him. Or maybe she's the latest in a long line of extracurricular affairs that I've been too blind to see. Either way, 68 more years of marriage, 68 more years of Dan and me together. It's a joke, a terrible, horrible joke. And I'm not laughing. I'm crying. For a while I stand motionless, watching dust motes float by. Then I blink, and half an hour has gone by, and I really should be getting to work. Not that this is the biggest priority in my life, quite frankly. Like an automaton, I get my things together, double-check the hob is turned off, OCD, and even leave a jaunty post-it for Dan with his keys saying, "Found them." Because what else am I going to write? "Found them, and found your secret texts to Mary, too, you cheating bastard." As I shut the front door, I see Toby emerging from Tilda's house in black jeans and a trilby. He's holding a massive great laundry bag spilling over with things and has a magazine in his mouth, like a dog. "Toby, can I help you?" I say. Toby shakes his head cheerfully and heads down the street, unaware that he's leaving a trail behind him of T-shirts, underwear, and vinyl records. "Toby!" Despite everything, I can't help smiling. "Your stuff, it's all falling out." I gather his things up and follow him along the street to where a white van is parked. He dumps the laundry bag in the back, where I see several more laundry bags, plus a desk, chair, and computer. "Wow," I say in astonishment. "What's going on?" "I'm moving out," he says, his eyes gleaming. "Moving out. Oh, yeah." "Oh, my God," I stare at him. "That's incredible. Where to?" "Hackney. My new job's in Shoreditch, so makes sense." "You've got a job?" I gape at him. "Job, flat, cat," he says in satisfaction. "Shared cat," he amends. "It's called Treacle. It belongs to Michi."
"Michi?"
"Michiko. My girlfriend."
"Toby has a girlfriend? Since when?"
"Well, congratulations," I say, stuffing his pants into the laundry bag and zipping it up. "But what about the start-up?" "It never did start up," says Toby, frankly. "That was the trouble with it."
We walk back from the van, just as Tilda emerges from her front door, and I wave to get her attention. She texted me last night, I suddenly remember, and told me her commute to Andover had finished for now, but I never texted back. As I get near, I can see that she's bright pink in the face and has a kind of suppressed energy about her. She's actually quivering, which makes sense. She must be so jubilant. At last. At last he's going, and he has a job, and a girlfriend. No more noise, no more rows, no more midnight pizza deliveries. I mean, I feel quite relieved, so I can only imagine how Tilda must feel. "This is amazing news," I greet her. "Toby seems so together all of a sudden."
"Oh, I know," Tilda nods vigorously. "He just announced it over supper 2 nights ago. I'm moving out. No warning, no build-up, just boom, I'm off."
"I'm so pleased for you. God, it's been a long time coming."
I lean forward to hug Tilda, then look more closely. Is she quivering with jubilation, or her eyes are bloodshot? I suddenly notice. Oh, my God.
"Tilda, I'm fine. Fine. Stupid."
She bats away my concerned look.
"Oh, Tilda," I peer into her kind, crumpled face, and of course now I can see it beneath her bustling, energetic, Tilderish manner. Grief. Because she's losing him. Finally.
"It just hit me," she says in a low voice, perching on the garden wall. "Ridiculous. I've been begging him to move out, but..."
"He's your baby," I say quietly, sitting down next to her. And we both watch as Toby makes another journey to the white van, carrying a kettle, a sandwich toaster, and a Nutribullet,
all trailing wires along the street.
"That's my Nutribullet," says Tilda, and I can't help laughing at her expression. "I know he has to move out," she adds, her eyes not moving from him. "I know he has to grow up. I know I pushed him to do all this," but tears start spilling from her eyes and she pulls a tissue out of her pocket. "Stupid," she says, shaking her head. "Stupid." I watch Toby returning to the house, oblivious of his mother's grief, bouncing up and down in his hipster trainers, humming a happy tune, ready to start his proper life.
"The girls will move out," I say, stricken. "They'll move out one day, without looking back."
I can suddenly see a grown-up Tessa and Anna, beautiful, leggy women in their 20s, brisk, checking their phones constantly, discounting everything I say, because I'm their mother. What do I know? I'm half hoping Tilda will say something comforting like, "Don't worry, your girls will be different," but she just shakes her head.
"It's not even that simple. They'll try you, hate you, scream at you, need you, tangle your heart up in theirs. Then they'll move out without looking back,"
There's silence for a while. She's right, and I don't know how I can dodge it. Some people make it look so easy, I say at last, exhaling hard. But Tilda shakes her head wryly. If love is easy, then you're not doing it right. We both watch as Toby carts a double duvet out of the front door. Hey, did you want to talk any more about your website, Sylvie? He says as he nears us, and I shake my head. We're not ready just yet. Thanks, though. Sure, says Toby and carries on down the street, the corners dragging on the dusty pavement. Mind the corners, Tilda yells after him. Then she shakes her head. Whatever, he's got a washing machine. I think Dan's having an affair, I say, staring straight ahead, my voice oddly calm. I found texts, secret texts, a locked drawer, the whole bit. Oh, fuck, Tilda grabs my arm. Fuck, Sylvie, you should have said. No, it's fine, it's fine. I'm going to, as I say the words, I realize I don't have the first idea what I'm going to do. It's fine, I say again. It'll be fine. Oh, love. Tilda's arm clamps around my shoulders and squeezes hard. It's shitty. You two seemed so... Of all the couples, I would have said, I know. I give a tremulous laugh. We were that couple. In fact, you know the really funny thing about Dan and me? I thought I knew him too well. I give a mirthless laugh. I thought we were too close. I wanted him to surprise me. Well, guess what? He did. He did. Look, Tilda sighs. Are you sure about this? Could there be any other... Have you talked about it with Dan? No, not yet. The very thought of talking about it with Dan makes my stomach turn over. I guess you just don't ever know the truth about people. But Dan... Tilda is shaking her head incredulously. Dan. The most loving, thoughtful... I remember him coming over to ours after your father died. He was so worried about you, obsessed by keeping the noise down so you could sleep. Asked us to walk around in our socks, which we did, she adds with a grin. Sorry about that, I wince. A depressing new thought hits me, and I sag. Maybe that's Dan's problem. My breakdown was all too much for him. There's a long, heavy silence between us. I can see Tilda's brow knitting. She says at last. Your breakdown? Episode, I amend awkwardly. However you describe it. Yes, I've heard you talk about your episode, but Tilda's brow is still deeply knitted. I mean, weren't you just going through grief? Well, yes, of course I was, I say puzzled. But I didn't cope well. That's what you've always said, and I've never wanted to contradict you, but Tilda sighs and turns to face me. Sylvie, I don't know if this will help right now, but here goes anyway. I don't think you had a breakdown. I think you went through grief, like any normal person. I stare back at her, discomforted, not knowing how to respond. But I wrote that letter, I say at last. I went to Gary Butler's house. So what? A couple of erratic moments. But Dan, my mother, they both said... They called a doctor. I wouldn't say your mother is any great judge of anything. Tilda cuts me off crisply. And Dan was always very protective of you. Maybe too much so. Has he ever lost anyone? Been bereaved? Well, no, I say, thinking aloud. No, he hasn't. No one close. So, he doesn't know. He wasn't prepared. He couldn't bear to see you suffering, and he wanted to cure you. Sylvie, grief is long and messy and horrible, but it's not an illness, and you cope how you cope. There's no well about it. She links her arm in mine, and we sit there silently for a while, and despite everything, I feel strengthened by what she's just said. It feels true. I don't know if that helps, she says at last. Probably not. No, it does, I say. It does. You always help. I squeeze her tight and give her an impulsive kiss, then get to my feet. I have to go. I'm late. Shall I walk with you? Offers Tilda at once, and I feel another wave of affection for her. No, no, I pat her shoulder. Stay. Say a proper goodbye to Toby. He'll be back. I add over my shoulder as I set off. He'll be back to see you. You wait. Chapter 14. As I travel to work, the maelstrom in my mind gradually, gradually calms down. Walking along the London pavements, I feel as though with every step I'm pushing my problems down, away. I mean, I have to get on with life, don't I? I can't sit crying and shaking at work. To my surprise, as I enter Willoughby House, Mrs. Kendrick is in the hall, along with Robert and an unfamiliar guy in a blue suit with a shaven head. The guy is looking around the spacious tiled hall with a practiced eye, and I instantly know he's in property. "Hello, Mrs. Kendrick," I say. "How lovely to see you here. It's been a while." "Sylvie, I'm so sorry." She puts a hand on my arm. "I know I've left you in the lurch recently. I've been rather busy." "Robert said you've been learning to use a computer." "Indeed I have. I have an Apple Mac." She says the words carefully, as though enunciating a foreign language. "Apple Mac." "Wow," I say. "Amazing." "Oh, you can do all sorts of things on it. I bought this online, you know." She plucks at the white frilly shirt she's wearing. "Do you see? They delivered it straight to my house from the shop. I just had to type in my credit card number. So convenient." She nods as though satisfied with herself. "And then I reviewed it on Review Your Stuff. 4 stars out of 5. Nice fabric, but the buttons are a little cheap. You can read my review if you like." I feel a bit speechless. Mrs. Kendrick has gone from barely knowing what a computer is to reviewing products online. "Right," I say at last. "Well, I don't know that particular website." "Oh, but you must. You must." She fixes me with a glittering eye. "Reviewing is the most marvelous hobby. You can review anything. I reviewed the policeman standing outside my block of flats yesterday." Robert turns and stares at her incredulously. "Aunt Margaret, you can't review policemen." "Of course you can," says Mrs. Kendrick crisply. "In the general category, you can review anything you like. Tea bags, holidays, policemen. I'm afraid I only gave him 3 stars. He was slightly dull about the eyes and wore his uniform badly." As she speaks, she eyes the shaven-headed guy meaningfully, and I bite my lip. Mrs. Kendrick is back on form, thank God for that. And I'm definitely going to look up some of her reviews. I just love the idea of Mrs. Kendrick's views on life being disseminated across the internet. The shaven-headed guy moves toward the rear of the hall, and I say quietly, "Who's that?" "That is Robert's guest. I believe his name is Mike." She enunciates Mike with slight disdain. "You know his name is Mike," says Robert patiently. "Really, Robert, this has nothing to do with me," says Mrs. Kendrick frostily. "You may proceed however you wish. When I'm dead, it will all be yours anyway." "Are you selling up?" I stare at Robert. "Weren't you going to give us a chance first?" "I'm finding out our options," he says a little testily. "Gathering information." "Some people give up," Mrs. Kendrick gives Robert a scathing look. "Others think outside the space." "Outside the space?" As Robert confronts Mrs. Kendrick, he seems beleaguered, and I wonder if this disagreement has been going on all morning. "Outside the space isn't even a saying. As I've told you, all I'm doing is getting a valuation." "And as I have told you, Robert," Mrs. Kendrick retorts crisply, "I have come up with an ingenious plan in which you do not seem interested. You may think I'm a dinosaur, but I can move with the times." Robert sighs. "Look, I am interested, but I need to deal with this first." "It is a forward-looking idea," Mrs. Kendrick turns to me. "It involves a smartphone." I clamp my lips together, trying not to smile. Mrs. Kendrick enunciates smartphone with the same care as Apple Mac, accentuating phone instead of smart. "Mavis, where is your smartphone?" She raises her voice. "We need the smartphone." Mavis is one of our most stalwart volunteers, a plump lady with dark bobbed hair, shapeless dresses and sturdy shoes, which she wears all year round. She's clutching an iPhone and brandishes it at Mrs. Kendrick. "Here you are, Margaret. Are you ready?" "Well, not quite," Mrs. Kendrick looks around the hall, as though seeing the occasional tables and porcelain urns and 18th-century paintings for the first time. What on earth is she planning to do? Take a selfie? Post a picture of Willoughby House online? Write a review? Where shall I stand? Mavis looks around. A few steps back, I think. Yes, Mrs. Kendrick nods. Perfect. I'm watching, intrigued, as they maneuver themselves round the hall. Mavis keeps holding her iPhone up as though to frame Mrs. Kendrick, and the pair of them seem to have something quite specific in mind.
Robert, to the left, says Mrs. Kendrick suddenly. Just a little, and Mike?
Even as she addresses him, she manages to make his name sound ridiculous.
Could you possibly stand on the stairs? Now, quiet, everyone. I'm going to film.
Before anyone can protest, she draws breath, beams at the iPhone and begins speaking, while simultaneously walking backward over the black and white tiled floor like a TV presenter.
Welcome to Willoughby House, she says in clear, distinct tones. A hidden gem in London, a treasure trove of art and antiquities, and a snapshot of what life was really like. Oh! Shit! Oh, my God!
Everyone cries out in horror as Mrs. Kendrick stumbles on the tiled floor and crashes heavily into a little circular table, knocking a blue and white urn flying. It seems almost to stop, poised in midair, before Robert, in a flying rugby tackle, hurls himself at it. He grasps the urn, rolls on the hard floor, and there's an audible crack as his head hits the stair banister.
Robert! Mrs. Kendrick shrieks. That's £20,000 you've just saved!
20 grand! Robert stares at the urn with such an expression of horror I want to laugh.
What's wrong with the bloody world? Who would pay 20 grand for this?
Are you all right, mate?
Mike descends the stairs.
Fine. Fine.
Slowly, grasping the urn tightly, Robert gets to his feet.
Are you all right, Mrs. Kendrick? I ask, because, after all, she got a bit of a bump too.
Of course I'm all right, says Mrs. Kendrick impatiently. Play it back, Mavis. Let's see it.
We all crane over Mavis's shoulder and watch Mrs. Kendrick backing over the tiles, talking in distinct, serene tones, stumbling, and then the total chaos that followed.
Oh, God, you can't help but laugh.
Next time, try walking forward, says Robert pointedly to his aunt as it finishes.
Well, at least the urn didn't break, I remind him.
20 grand.
Robert is still staring incredulously at the urn.
For a pot. Is that insured separately? I mean, shouldn't it be in a locked case?
But Mrs. Kendrick isn't listening to any of us. She's saying, put it on Twitter, Mavis, and YouTube. Load it up now. She looks at Robert and me.
Everyone must start twittering, she says firmly. Sharing. Whatever you call it.
What? I say stupidly.
Twittering! If we want to go viral, we have to Twitter. Now, what should we call it?
Viral? A sudden suspicion is forming in my mind, and as I glance at Robert, I see he's thinking the same way.
Aunt Margaret, he says in even tones, was that faked?
Of course it was faked, says Mrs. Kendrick with asperity.
Robert, as I said, I'm not a dinosaur. The more people see this video, the more people will know the name of Willoughby House.
I've just asked my grandson's advice, announces Mavis breathlessly, looking up from her phone. He suggests that awkward moment when your priceless urn nearly breaks.
Marvellous, Mrs. Kendrick nods at Mavis.
Type it in, dear.
But you let me dive to the floor. I bumped my head,
Robert sounds really quite aggrieved.
I was afraid you wouldn't be able to act,
Mrs. Kendrick gives him a frosty smile.
And what if the urn had broken? He demands. That would have been 20 grand. You risked 20 grand for a viral video.
Oh, Robert, Mrs. Kendrick gives him a supremely pitying look.
Have a little sense. It's not really worth £20,000. I bought it from John Lewis.
Robert looks so apoplectic I want to laugh. Although I'm not sure if it's because his aunt has got one over on him, or because his head is still sore, or because Mike gives a sudden snort of laughter.
I'll leave you to it, I say diplomatically, and head upstairs to the office.
And the whole thing has almost, kind of, sort of cheered me up. Sure enough, the video is soon up on YouTube, and every time I check, it's been viewed by another 50 or so people. It's not exactly a sneezing panda, but I do think Mrs. Kendrick has the right idea. But even a viral video can't keep my spirits up. I get through the day on a kind of autopilot, and by 4 p.m, I'm really in the pits. Clarissa has gone out to see a prospect, and it started to rain, and I'm sitting at the computer desk, head slumped in my arms, when I hear the tread of Robert on the stairs. Hastily, I sit up and resume the email I started about 3 hours ago. "Oh, hello," I say as he appears, in an absent sort of voice, as though I'm in the middle of concentrating. "Has Mike gone, then?" I can't help calling him Mike, with a sardonic tone, just like Mrs. Kendrick did. "Yes, Mike has gone," Robert sounds amused. "And have you sold the place for 20 million? I add, without looking up. "Oh, at least." "Good, because I wouldn't want you to starve," I briskly sign off my email. "It's okay," he says, deadpan. "The orphans that I trample over on my way to cash my ill-gotten money can cook me some roast suckling pig while they're sweeping my capitalist chimneys." I can't help a tiny smile curving my lips. He's funnier than he lets on, Robert. I finally raise my head and wince at the sight of the bruise which has sprouted on his forehead. "You hurt yourself," I say.
"Yes, thank you," he says in mock aggrieved tones. "That's what I was trying to say."
"Has Mrs. Kendrick gone too?"
"Yes, she's in a meeting with Elon Musk," he says, and I nearly exclaim, "Really?" before I realize he's joking. "Ha," I say. "On the plus side," Robert says, "while I was showing Mike around, we found this."
He lifts up a bottle of wine in his right hand. "Oh, yes," I say without much interest. "That's the Christmas wine. We give it to the volunteers every year."
"Chateau Lafitte,"
repeats Robert, and I realize he's making a point.
"Chateau Lafitte."
"Well, you know," I shrug. "Mrs. Kendrick likes the best." Robert looks at me, then stares at the wine bottle, then shakes his head incredulously.
"Every time I think this place can't get any madder, it does. Well, let's see if it is the best, shall we? Got any glasses?"
I fetch a couple of cut crystal glasses from the trolley, which is where we keep our sherry, nuts, and crisps.
"You're well kitted out," says Robert, watching me. "Don't tell me, Mrs. Kendrick."
"She likes to have a glass of sherry if we stay late," I explain.
"Of course she does."
Robert pours out 2 glasses of the Chateau Lafitte, and even though I'm not a wine buff, I can tell from the smell alone that it's special.
"Cheers."
Robert holds up his glass, and I clink it with mine, and I suddenly need a drink so badly I gulp down about half.
"Have some snacks,"
I say, decanting some little cheesy biscuits into a cut glass bowl. Robert sits down on an office chair, and we drink. Silently, hoovering the cheesy biscuits. After a while, I open another packet, and Robert replenishes our glasses. He still looks incongruous up here, with his big shoes and deep voice, and way of pushing things aside without even noticing. "Careful," I say as he leans back, his elbow casually on the computer desk, and knocks over Clarissa's pile of leather-bound exercise books. "Those are the books."
"The books?"
"We write summaries of all our meetings," I explain. "Time, person, subject. They're actually incredibly useful. They go back years and years." Robert picks up the exercise books. He flicks through one of them, reading Clarissa's careful entries in fountain pen, then puts it back with a sigh.
"You're all getting under my skin, you know that. The dish, the ladder, the books, the wine. It's like bloody Alice in Wonderland up here."
He looks around the office with what seems like genuine ruefulness.
"I don't want to force this place into the real world, but I have to. We can't stave off reality forever."
"I'm looking into websites," I say quickly. "I've done another appeal to supporters. Or we could sell off some pieces, raise some cash that way." I break off as Robert shakes his head.
"That would take us so far," he says. "But what then? Sell 3 paintings every year till they're all gone? This place needs to be sustainable."
"It needs an injection of cash," I counter. "Just one lump sum would really help us.
It's had injections of cash, Robert sounds frustrated. Year after year. There's a limit. Do you realize how much my aunt...
He stops himself and I feel an uneasy twinge. I have no idea how much Mrs. Kendrick has spent propping us up.
So, you're really going to sell?
I can't help a catch in my voice.
You said you'd give us a chance.
I haven't said I won't, Robert says, after a pause. Nothing's definite. It's just...
He exhales.
It's a big job. Bigger than I first imagined. It's not just turning round an ocean liner. It's turning round an ocean liner while also saving the ocean liner from sinking. YouTube videos won't save us. A new website... Well, maybe, but maybe not.
The rain is drumming on the windows as he refreshes my glass. I can feel sadness settling about me like a cloud. So that's it. The end of an era. At home, maybe it's the end of another era. And suddenly I can't stop tears rolling down my cheeks. I was so happy. My life made sense. Now I feel like the whole lot is unraveling. Job, income, husband.
Oh, God, Sylvie, I'm sorry.
Robert looks perturbed.
Look, as I say, it's not for definite. It won't be for a while. We'll help you find new positions.
It's not that.
I take out my hanky and wipe my face. Sorry, it's personal stuff.
Ah, he says,
and there's an immediate shift in the air. I can actually feel the molecules changing. It's as if my professional life was a beaker of clear water, and now I've introduced a drop of home life color, and it's slowly seeping through everything. I glance up, as though to reassure myself that Robert isn't remotely interested in my ridiculous private affairs. But he's leaning forward, a crease in his forehead as though he is interested. Very interested. His hair is about twice the thickness of Dan's, I find myself noticing, randomly, thick and dark and shiny. And I can smell his aftershave from here. It's expensive. Nice.
I won't pry,
says Robert after a long pause.
It's not, I shrug.
I wipe my nose, trying to get control of myself. Are you married? I find myself asking. I don't even know why.
No, he pauses. I was with someone.
Right.
But even that wasn't easy. Marriage, he shrugs too.
Yep.
But I will say one thing.
Robert gulps his wine.
I probably shouldn't, but I will. If your husband has, in any way, if he, for one moment, if he doesn't realize what he has,
he breaks off and looks at me full on, his eyes dark and unreadable.
Then he's mad. He's mad.
I can feel my skin shimmer under Robert's gaze. I'm transfixed by his eyes, his shiny hair, his forthright manner. He's so different from Dan. He's a different variety of man, a different flavor altogether. If life is like a box of chocolates, then getting married is like choosing a chocolate and saying, "That's it, done," and slamming the lid closed. When you make your vows, what you're basically saying is, "That's all I want, ever, that one flavor." Even if it goes off. Yum. I can't even see any other flavors anymore. La la la.
And it might be your favorite flavor. And you might truly love it. But can you help it if you sometimes look over at the honeycomb crunch and think,
He's mad, Robert repeats, his eyes still locked on mine. Do you want to get something to eat? He adds more tentatively.
In a flash, a door in my mind seems to open. Through it I can see a glittering, beckoning chain of events, starting right now. Dinner, more drinks, laughter and a blurred head and a screw-you-Dan kind of exhilaration. A hand on my arm, murmurings in my ear. Dancing? A taxi? The dimly lit corridor of a hotel, unfamiliar lips on mine, hands peeling off my clothes, a new body against mine. It would be good. And it would be terrible. It would screw me up. I'm just not in that place. I don't know what place I am in, but it's not that one.
No, thanks,
I say at last, my breath a little jagged.
I'd better go and... But thanks. Thanks. Really. Thanks.
I get home before Dan, say goodbye to Karen with a cheery smile, put the children to bed, and then just wait in the kitchen, feeling like a Bond villain. "I've been expecting you, Mr. Winter." That's my line, except it's not true. Until last night, I didn't expect any of this. Extra marital affairs, secret drawers, little messages. Are you kidding? I've looked at the photos on my phone about 1,000 times today. I've read Dan's texts over and over. They're so familiar-sounding, so Dan-like, just like the kind of texts he'd send to me. But not to me. The one that really makes my stomach clench is, remember, P.S. factor. The Princess Sylvie factor. I'm not his beloved wife. I'm a factor. Not to mention the fact that Princess Sylvie is a very private little nickname that makes me flinch for all sorts of reasons. And now he's using it with her. I just don't get it. The Dan I know is caring and solicitous, protective of us, of what we've made together. Our home, our family, our world. Can you really not know someone you've been so close to? Can you really be so blind? I don't know exactly what I'm going to say. What I do know is, I'm not going to greet him by waving the evidence in his face, because what do I gain by doing that? Nothing, except a momentary flash of vindictive glee, which actually is fairly appealing right now. But then what happens? I've caught him out. I win. Except it doesn't feel like winning. Winning would be, he decides to confess everything, totally, spontaneously, and is really sorry, and has some explanation which makes everything right. What explanation? Don't know. Not my job. Or even better, we go back in time and none of this ever happened. The sound of his key in the lock makes me jump. Fuck. I'm not ready. I hastily smooth down my hair and take a few deep breaths. My heart is pounding. So hard. I feel like it must be audible. But as Dan comes in, he doesn't seem to hear it or notice anything. He looks knackered, and his brow is screwed up as though he can't escape his thoughts. As he drops his briefcase, he exhales with a weary sigh. Any other night, I'd say, "Are you okay?" and get him a cup of tea or a drink. But not tonight. If he's knackered, maybe he shouldn't make so many complicated arrangements in his private life. I spit the words out in the privacy of my own brain and almost wish he could hear them. "All right," I say shortly. "I've had better days." Dan rubs his brow and I feel a flare of fury, which I quell. "I think we need to talk," I say. "Sylvie," Dan looks up as though this is the last straw. "I'm shattered. It's been a fuck of a day. I have calls I need to make." "Oh, calls?" I retort sarcastically before I can stop myself. "Yes, calls," he stares at me. "What kind of calls? Just calls." I'm breathing hard, my thoughts are skittering around. I need to gather myself. "I just think we should be honest with each other," I say, feeling my way. "Really, really honest. Let's have a new project where we confess everything. Project Clean Slate." "For fuck's sake," Dan mutters. "I need a drink." He looks as if Project Clean Slate is the last thing he wants in his life, but I press on determinedly as he gets a beer from the fridge. "We need to connect, and to connect, you need to be totally straightforward and not hide anything, like..." I scrabble hastily around. "Like, I found a post-it that I'd written for myself the other day. Your mum had called and I totally forgot to tell you. Sorry." There's silence and I look at Dan, expectantly. "What?" he says. "Your turn, Project Clean Slate. There must be something you haven't told me. It could be anything." I trail off, my heart beating even faster. Already, I know this isn't going to work. It was a stupid idea. I confess a missed phone message, and he confesses an entire affair. "Sylvie, I really don't have time for this," Dan says, and something about his terse, dismissive tone makes me see red. "You don't have time for your marriage," I explode. "You don't have time to talk about the hiccups in our relationship." "What hiccups?" Dan sounds irritable. "Why are you always inventing problems?" "Inventing?"
I want to scream.
Did I invent your texts?
There's silence in the kitchen, apart from the ticking of our wall clock. We bought it together in IKEA before we were married. We didn't even need to discuss it. We were both instantly drawn to the same one, with a big black rim and no numerals. I remember thinking, God, we're so in sync. What a joke.
Dan pulls up a chair and sits down, and he looks exactly like the husband I've known and loved all these years, except he's not, is he? He's stuffed full of secrets. I'm bubbling over again. I need to confront him. If I can't bring myself to brandish his texts to Mary, I can brandish something else.
I know you're cooking up something at work, I fling out at him. I heard you at the hospital, talking to my mother. £1 million, maybe two, huh, Dan? Is that what you're borrowing, without telling me? Is this for that Copenhagen business?
For fuck's sake, Dan's eyes widen. I heard you.
I know my voice is shrill, but I can't help it. £1 million, maybe two. Jesus, Dan, this is our future you're gambling on, and I know exactly what it's about, really.
Oh, yes, Dan says in ominous tones. What's it about? Really?
Seriously? He's asking this.
My father! I almost yell.
What do you think? It's always about my father. You can't stand that daddy was rich and successful. You can't stand that he was admired. You look miserable any time anyone says anything nice about him.
I do not, snaps Dan.
Oh my God, Dan, are you for real? I almost want to laugh, except it's not funny. Have you seen yourself? It's completely obvious. And that's why you want to expand your company, not because it's good for us as a family, but because you've got to compete with my father, who, by the way, is dead. Dead! You're so bloody chippy, and I'm sick of it.
I break off, panting, tears rising, half terrified. I can't believe I called Dan chippy. It's a word I vowed never, ever to use. But now I have. I've crossed the line.
A vein is twitching in Dan's forehead. He stares at me for a few silent moments, and I can see a million thoughts passing through his eyes. But I can't read any of them.
I can't do this, he says abruptly, pushing back his chair.
Can't do what? I throw after him. But he doesn't answer, just strides into the hall and up the stairs.
Dan! I hurry after him furiously.
Come back! We need to talk! Jesus, Sylvie!
Dan pauses halfway up the stairs and wheels round.
Are you for real? We do not need to talk. I'm fucking talked out. I need to have some space. Some space. To think, to... I need space. Space.
He clutches his head.
Space.
Oh! Space! I say as scathingly as I can, because my heart is beating a tattoo of panic. This has all gone far worse than I expected, far more quickly. I want to pull it back. I want to say, please, please, Dan, tell me you don't love her. But I'm petrified of what he might say. So much for knowing him inside out, for being psychic, for finishing off his sentences. I have no idea what he's about to say anymore. I feel almost faint with fear standing here in my familiar hall, staring up at my unfamiliar husband. He's gazing at me with a wry expression that makes my hair stand on end, because it's not one of our looks. It's the kind of look you might give to a stranger.
I meant to tell you, he says at last in a voice that doesn't ring true. I've got a trip tomorrow. I need to fly up to Glasgow. I might as well go and stay at an airport hotel tonight.
Glasgow, I stare at him.
Why Glasgow?
Possible new supplier, he says, looking away. And my heart plunges. He's lying. I can tell. He's going to her.
Fine. I manage the single syllable, even though my lungs feel like they're packing up.
Tell the girls I'll be back soon. Give them a kiss.
Fine.
He turns and trudges up the stairs, and I stand, motionless, replaying our conversation in my head on a loop, feeling as if any move I make might be wrong. After a few minutes he's back, holding the leather weekend bag I gave him our first Christmas together.
Dan, listen, I swallow, trying not to sound desperate.
Why don't you stay here tonight? Couldn't you drive to the airport in the morning?
I have stuff I need to do, he says, staring resolutely past me.
It'll be simpler if... I'll text Karen. I'm sure she'll do some extra hours. Take care of the school run.
The school run? Is that what he thinks I'm worried about? The school run.
Okay. I can barely get the word out. I'll be a day or two. I'll keep you posted.
He kisses me on the forehead, then heads to the front door with his swift, determined stride. Within 10 seconds he's gone, and I'm still standing motionless, almost light-headed with shock. What just happened? A sudden thought comes to me, and I dart upstairs to his study. I wrench open his top drawer, and his passport is inside, where it's always kept. Dan's not the type to forget his passport. He's not flying anywhere. I pick up the passport, open it, and stare at Dan's impassive photo face, feeling sick. The man I thought couldn't keep secrets from me turns out to be a pretty good liar. And now, humiliation is descending upon me like a suffocating blanket. It's so sordid, so predictable. My husband has walked out on me for his mistress, leaving me to look after the kids. This is my reality. I thought we were different. Special. But we're just like every other tedious, messed-up marriage in southwest London. With a sudden half-sob, half-scream, I grab my phone and start texting him with stabby fingers. Go off and enjoy yourself, then. Talk about surprising each other. You're such a predictable, boring, fucking cliché. I send the text, then collapse down onto the floor. I'm beyond crying. I'm beyond thought. We were that couple. We were always that couple. Now, we're that couple. Chapter 15. I remember this from when Daddy died. At first you're numb. You function perfectly. You smile and crack jokes. You think, wow, it's actually all fine. I must be a really strong person. Who knew? And it's only later that the pain swallows you up and you start dry heaving into your sink. I'm still at the numb stage. I've got the girls ready for school. I've chatted merrily with Karen and mentioned Dan being really busy with work. I've waved at Professor Russell, John, through the window. I could easily have done the school run. But Dan clearly texted Karen last night claiming a state of emergency because she pitched up at 7 a.m., all ready to swing into action. They've just left, and the house has that super silent feeling it gets whenever the children leave it. It's just me and the snake, which, thank God, does not need feeding for another 5 days. If Dan isn't back by then, I'm giving it to the RSPCA. I put on more makeup than usual, savagely jabbing at my eyes with a mascara wand. I step into a pair of high heels because I feel height will help me today. I'm in my jacket, ready to leave for work, when the post rattles through the letterbox and I pick it up, thinking dazedly, what do I do if there's post for Dan? Forward it on? Where? But it's just a couple of catalogues in a handwritten envelope, creamy and expensive. Nice handwriting, slanted and elegant. I stare at it, in mounting suspicion. That can't be from. She wouldn't have. I rip it open and something seems to stab my stomach. It is. It's from her. She's written us a bloody thank you letter. I scan the anodyne words, but I can't digest them. I can't focus. All I can think is, how dare you? How dare you? Both of them. Him, her, with their texts and secret hugs, treating me like a fool. A new energy is suffusing me. A new incandescent fury. Last night I played it all wrong. I was wrong-footed. I didn't react quickly enough. I didn't say the stuff I should have said. I keep going over the scene, wishing I had confronted Dan with those texts, that I had shoved everything out in the open. What was I thinking of, waiting for him to confess? Why was he ever going to do that? So, today I'm taking charge. My husband's lover may get to do a lot of things, But she does not get to write me a two-faced thank you letter, laughing at me behind my back. She does not get to do that. I send a text to Clarissa. Just popping to London Library for research. Then Google Mary's company, Green Pear Consulting. It's in Bloomsbury. Easy. As I emerge from the tube at Goode Street, I'm walking snappily, my legs like scissors, my fists are clenched at my sides, my jaw is tight. I feel ready for body blows. I arrive at the address to find one of those tall London houses with about 10 companies on 5 different floors and a rickety lift, and a receptionist whose aim seems to be to misunderstand you at every turn. But at last, after an excruciating conversation between the receptionist and someone on the phone at Green Pear Consulting, "No, she don't have no appointment. No, no appointment. She called Sylvie. Sylvie Winter. For Mary. Mary." I'm on my way up the stairs to the 4th floor. I'm pretty fit, but my heart is already pounding and my skin keeps breaking out in goosebumps. I feel unreal. Finally, finally, I'm going to get some answers. Or some payback. Or something. I get to the top and push my way through a heavy fire door. And there's Mary, waiting for me on a tiny landing, as beautiful as ever, in a grey linen shift dress. She looks shocked to see me, I notice with satisfaction. Not so tranquil now. "Sylvie," she says. "They phoned up and told me someone called Sylvie was here, but I didn't, I mean, you didn't know why I was here?" I say scathingly. "Really? You have no idea?" There's silence, and I can see Mary's dark eyes flickering with thought. Then she says, "Maybe we should go to my office." She leads me to a tiny room and gestures to a chair opposite her desk. It's quite a bare space, all pale wood and posters for environmental causes, and a striking abstract painting, which I would ask her about in different circumstances. Mary sits down, but I don't. I want the advantage of height. "So," I say in my most cutting tones, "thanks for your letter." I take it out of my bag and throw it onto her desk, and she flinches, startled. "Right." She picks the envelope up warily, then replaces it on her desk. "Is there a... are you..." She tries a third time. "Sylvie." "Yes," I say as unforgivingly as I can. I'm certainly not making this easy for her. "Is something wrong? Is something wrong?" "Oh, come on, Mary," I snap. "So you're having a secret thing with him. An affair. He's moved in with you, whatever. But don't send me a letter saying thank you for the lovely dinner, okay?" I break off, breathing hard, and Mary stares at me, her jaw dropped. "Moved in with me. What on earth? Nice try." "Oh, God." Mary clutches her head. "I need to unpick all this. Sylvie, I'm not having an affair with Dan. And he hasn't moved in with me, okay?" "Oh, right," I say icily. "I suppose he hasn't sent you secret texts either. I suppose he didn't tell you he feels pinned in a corner. I saw you talking, Mary. I saw you hugging, so you can stop the play-acting, okay? I know." There's silence, and I can see I've got to Mary. I've punctured her serene veneer. She looks quite rattled for an angel. "We did talk that night," she says at last. "And, yes, we did hug. But as old friends, nothing more. Dan wanted to open up to me, and I found myself listening, talking." She suddenly rises from her chair, so she's at eye level with me. "But Dan and I are not having an affair. We're really, really not. Please believe me." "Old friends," I echo the word sarcastically. "Yes." Her face suddenly flushes. "Just that. I don't have affairs with married men. I wouldn't do that." "What about the texts?" I fling back at her. "I've only sent him a couple of texts. We've chatted, nothing more, I promise." "But you've met up at Starbucks? At Villandry?" "No," she shakes her head. "At your house, we talked about meeting up, possibly. That's all. He just wanted to talk to me. Download, that's all." "Download about what?" There's an edge to my voice. "About how I'm nuts." "What?" She blinks at me in shock.
No. Stop denying it, I erupt. I've seen the texts. Running late, sorry. It's okay. Have distracted S. I make jabbing, quotey gestures at her. Remember PS Factor. I've read them. There's no point lying.
I have no idea what you're talking about. She appears baffled. What's the PS Factor? And he's never been running late because we've never met up.
I'm breathing hard. Seriously. Look. I summon up the photos I took of Dan's secret phone and thrust them in front of her. Remember these? Mary looks down, her forehead delicately wrinkled, then shakes her head.
I've never seen these texts in my life.
What? I'm almost shouting. But they're to Mary? Look, Mary!
I don't care, they're not to me.
For a moment we just stare at each other. My mind is scrabbling around and around trying to find an explanation. Then Mary grabs the phone. She flicks through the photos until she comes to a text from Mary, reading, New mobile number from tomorrow, followed by a string of digits.
That's not my number, she says calmly. Those aren't my texts.
I'll show you my phone, if you like. You can read the texts Dan sent me, all three of them, and you'll see how innocent they are. She grabs an iPhone from where it's charging and swipes it open. A moment later, I'm looking at three texts from Dan, all beginning, Hi, Mary, and all along the lines of, So great to make contact. Mary's right. They're all innocent, and even quite formal. Nothing like the intimate, casual ease of the other texts.
I don't know who this is.
She jerks a thumb at the photos on my phone.
But you have the wrong woman.
But, I sink into a chair, my legs trembling. I feel shoffed. I feel so shoffed, I'm breathless. Who's this other Mary? How many Marys does Dan have in his life? At last, I glance up at Mary, who seems equally perplexed. She's swiping slowly through my photos, and I can see her grimacing.
I can see why you're alarmed, she says.
What are you going to do?
Don't know.
I lift a helpless hand and drop it. Dan went off somewhere last night. He said it was a work trip, but I don't believe him.
Is he with her?
No, says Mary at once. I can't believe it. He wouldn't do that. I think more likely. She stops as though a thought has occurred to her, and I sit up, alert.
What?
I demand.
What did he say to you? Did he confide in you?
Not exactly. He started to, but then he stopped himself. Mary sighs.
I felt bad for him. He's really stressed out at the moment.
I know he's stressed out, I exclaim in frustration.
But he won't tell me why. I don't even know where to start. It's like there's some massive great secret. But how can I help him if I don't know what's going on?
Mary is swiping through the photos again, reading the texts carefully. Her brow is furrowed and she seems troubled. She looks as though she's wrestling with a dilemma. She looks as though...
Oh, my God,
I stare at her.
He did tell you something, didn't he?
What? Mary looks up and I can tell I've hit the mark. Her mouth is clamped shut, her eyes are pained. Clearly he revealed something to her and she's protecting him, because she's a good person and she thinks it's the right thing to do.
But it's the wrong thing to do.
Please, Mary, I lean forward, trying to convey the urgency of the situation. I know you're his friend, and you want to respect Dan's confidence, but maybe the best way to help him is to break his confidence. I'll never ever say it was you who told me, I add hurriedly, and I'll do the same for you, I promise. I can't see how an equivalent situation will ever arise, but I mean it. If it does, I will totally reveal everything to Mary.
He didn't tell me any details, says Mary reluctantly. Not properly. But yes, there is something. He said it was clogging up his life. He called it his ongoing nightmare.
His ongoing nightmare? I echo in dismay. Dan has an ongoing nightmare that I don't know about. But how can he? What is it? What hasn't he told me?
That's the phrase he used. He didn't give any other details, except she bites her soft pink lip, looking uncomfortable.
What?
I'm nearly popping with frustration.
Okay, she exhales. Whatever it is, it has to do with your mother.
My mother? I gape at her.